little bit about the Open Business Project. This is a project that we developed in the past. We have been developing in the past like 4 years, 3 years, with the support of IDRC. And basically what we are interested in is in how technology has been appropriated by the peripheries, what we call the peripheries, not only in Brazil, but also like global peripheries. We did research also in Colombia. We did research in Argentina, Mexico, and Nigeria. And basically, what we were looking at was based on a hypothesis that actually there were business models, especially about cultural production like music and film, emerging from these global peripheries. And actually, our idea and our initial belief was that these business models were actually making more money than the traditional business models. So basically, we went to the field. We went to a state in Brazil that is called Pará. It's in the north of the country. And we started researching this musical scene that is called Tecnobrega. Brega in Portuguese means cheesy or kitschy. So it's the mix of the techno beats, like in the 80s, with the cheesiest romantic sort of music that you see everywhere. And it's kind of very interesting. It's great for dancing and is extremely popular. So one of the things that we noticed about the Tecnobrega scene is that they didn't really care about copyright. And it's funny because they were releasing almost like 400 new CDs per year and almost like 100 new DVDs per year. And if you go to a store to try to find one of those CDs and DVDs, you wouldn't find them because they were being sold directly through these street vendors, like the same guys who traditionally would sell pirated stuff. These were the distribution channels for the Tecnobrega. So it's a very interesting phenomenon because there was an alliance between the musicians, the producers, and these street vendors that worked as a channel of very broad distribution for their music. So we went there because we wanted to understand the economics of this entire musical scene, and we got the numbers. So we did like a one-year research. We interviewed a lot of musicians, a lot of street vendors, and we were really fascinated by what we got, like, because it was a multi-million dollar music industry, and basically the artists were being paid much better than in other sorts of business models, and the amount of CDs being sold were great. And actually, one of the things that we found is that the artists themselves were able to sell CDs and DVDs after their concerts, and that did not compete with the CDs that were being sold by the street vendors, for instance. It's two completely different markets. One captures this present value of playing live and getting people excited about what you do, and the other is like a completely different, more, a cheaper market, like you buy CDs for a cheaper price. So it's a very interesting thing because it combines openness in the sense that the artists, they don't care that their music is openly distributed either through the street vendors online or anything else, with payments to the artists that are sustainable. And actually, the artists get, the more their music gets distributed, the more popular they get, the more they're invited to play live. So it's very interesting. And this was our research about the Tecnobrega scene. We launched the book recently. It's called Tecnobrega, Pará, which is the name of the state, Reinventing the Music Business. And hopefully it's going to be translated into English at some point. But one very important thing is that this model that we found out in Pará is not particular from that specific scene. There's a global thing going on about these open business models, especially if you think about music and how music is now being produced and like by means of technology, especially in these poorer areas, in the, what we call the peripheries. You will see that the same model that applies to Tecnobrega applies also to many other genres of music inside Brazil, like funk carioca in Rio, lambadão cuiabano, forró da Amazônia, well, many others. But it also applies to other places everywhere. So for instance, the same business model that we found for Tecnobrega is similar to the Kuduro in Angola, to the Queto in South Africa, to Cumbia Vigera in Argentina, to Coupé de Calais in the Ivory Coast, and so it goes. So basically, what is going on is that there is this new forms of producing music and distributing music that is pretty much different from the traditional business model of music. And in economic terms, in many cases, it's even more sound and it's even more sustainable than what we see in the traditional business model. So it's basically the rules are artists produce it, they don't care about copyright, they distribute it freely, and in return, there's a very sophisticated, innovative process that allows them to keep generating new revenues by means of innovation everywhere else. So basically, that was the first part of our business, open business project.
Wow. That's awesome. Both the research and your description. As I was writing down questions, and I was like, okay, you answered that question. I said, So that's a fabulous example of what happens within music and mm-hmm. what happens within music, not just in Brazil, but in yep. other countries. So can you tell us a little bit about film,
yep.
for instance,
right.
both in whether yes. in Brazil or in other countries?
Right. Okay. So basically, let me start with the Nigerian film industry. That's something we researched as well. And that is also very fascinating because what happens is the United States releases approximately 600 new films per year. On top of that, you have India. India releases 950 films per year. And then on top of that, you have Nigeria. Nigeria releases 1,200 films per year. But the funny thing is that all the films are made directly to DVD. The films, they are much cheaper to produce, of course, than like Hollywoodian movies. They cost like from $30,000 to $100,000 to produce each. They are shot in high-definition video in most of the cases, so they don't use celluloid or any of those expensive processes. It's directly into video. And they're sold by $3 a piece, and you can buy them everywhere, in street vendors, in shops, in markets. So they have a very sophisticated distribution market for the films. And Nigeria is the third largest film business in the world in terms of revenue. So basically, first you have the United States very far away on the top, then you have India, then you have Nigeria generating approximately $200 million in revenues per year. And generating, this is according to a research, not that we did, but to The Economist, the magazine, 1 million jobs. So basically, it's very interesting because if you look at the global scenario of movie production, there are only a few countries where are actually successful in competing with Hollywood. For instance, you have China, for obvious reasons. You have Korea, which is worldwide famous for having a local film production that is very competitive. You have, for instance, India, which for cultural reasons have like their own particular film industry. And then you have Nigeria in this list. And it's a very interesting model because when you talk with the Nigerian producers, they are really smart about what they are doing. They know exactly. The market is not concentrated. It's actually completely decentralized. There are several small production companies that compete with each other. And the interesting thing is that they talk things, they say things like, we don't like to do the Hollywood model because it's completely obsolete. Like you still are pretty much based in celluloid. So we came directly to video. We start shooting like in high definition. So basically the Nigerian film business, when you look, for instance, to the Brazilian way of shooting movies, that depends heavily on governmental support. And sometimes films cost $3 million to produce, $5 million to produce, and are watched by less than 100,000 people. When you compare that to the fact that you have this film business emerging from the bottom up using like cheap digital technology, you have a lot to think about what should the should be the policies for supporting like movie productions in film in countries like developing countries like Brazil. So it's very interesting because once I talked like with the film production group that works in one of the Brazilian favelas, and it was very funny because I asked them, so these movies that you guys are producing in the favelas, who watched them? And then they said, oh, a lot of people watch these movies. And I said, like what? I say, oh, 400 people. I say, oh, 400 people. And how are your movies watched? They say, well, just like any other movies. You first put the movie in film festivals, and then you produce DVDs and you sell them in stores. And then I said, that's very interesting. So have you guys ever thought about, like, for instance, getting your films and distributing it inside the favelas directly through the street vendors, for instance? And the guy said, you are a genius. How can you come up with such a brilliant idea? We never thought about it. And that was very revealing because if you think about it, this possibility always existed. But everybody, even the people in the favelas, had in their minds the Hollywood-type business models, which is basically it depends on selling the same film 5 or 6 times in order to be sustainable. So basically Hollywood sells the films to the movie theaters first, then it sells to airlines, then it sells to DVD distributors, then it sells to video on demand, then to DVD. You know, you have to sell the same film through the windows of distribution windows several times. But the smart thing about the Nigerian business model is basically that you have only one shot to sell your film. You invested like $50,000, you print like a number of copies, either you sell those and recoup your investment or not. So they do not depend on a very complex like a distribution window system in order to recoup their investments. And I mentioned that to these guys in the favelas in Brazil, and they were kind of shocked because they even them had like sort of introjected the Hollywood vision of how to do business, and they had never thought that it could be possible, for instance, to skip the movie theaters and try to distribute the films through alternative channels. So basically, that's the lessons that we learned like by studying the Nigerian model.
So it sounds like the way that you're describing openness is is manifest in a few different ways. One, you're talking kind of in terms of intellectual property sorts of openness, so doing things differently in that regard, but also in terms of openness to do things differently in general. So the model is different for low-cost, immediate recouping of film of investments in the case of films, but also viewing the whole business process, who your partners are, and so forth differently. So, and in some instances, it seems like, especially in the music example you gave, you're really looking at an open ecosystem where everyone can kind of profit off this, where there really is, in a sense, collaborative, even though it's kind of peer produced in the classic sense, where people are operating basically independently of one another. The other one is more just as kind of focused. Do you want to talk more about the ways that you're, so the characteristics of open business?
Right. When we first started, like the definition of open business, it would be like situations in which you had like cultural production businesses where intellectual property was not the main factor. So that applies not only to the Tecnobrega music scene in Brazil, but it also applies to the Nigerian film business. Because, especially because when you think about the recent history of this industry, it always started in the 90s, where Nigeria didn't even have a proper copyright law. And actually, another smart thing about the Nigerian model is that the films are sold by $3, while the media costs $1. So if you want to pirate one of the films, your profit will be in the most best case like $1. So why are you going to do that? And actually, when you talk with the producers about piracy, they say that actually piracy helped them to open new markets. So for instance, piracy only took place when they could not distribute the films themselves. So basically, they were interested about the films in Ghana, in Tanzania, in other countries, but they could not get there at the moment. So basically, the pirates did the job, and then they created like new audiences for the films. And it's very interesting because the guys have a very rational approach to piracy. They say, is it a cost? Yes, it is. I put it under marketing costs because that's what it is. Piracy is basically opening new markets for my product. So that's what they say. So it's a very interesting thing. And this kind of flexibility regarding intellectual property, it's basically everywhere where you talk about these kinds of open business that are emerging from the peripheries. And that comes for a very specific reason, which is, if you think about it, there's a new sort of commons that is emerging in the peripheries. It's not a legal-based commons, in which you have someone licensing their works under Creative Commons, or it's not the public domain that is granted by the law. It's not like exceptions, limitations, or even fair use. All that derives from the law. These commons that we investigated in the peripheries is what we called a social commons, because they are not legal. They are a de facto situation that emerges from the fact that intellectual property in these areas is basically unknown or irrelevant, unenforceable, or there is a sort of a tacit agreement between copyright holders not to enforce their intellectual property against the infringers. So this is very interesting because if you think about this idea of a social commons, it's not only in the peripheries, but it's also basically everywhere when you think about digital business. For a long time, for instance, YouTube was a big, huge social commons in which you had a lot of infringing materials, allegedly, and you could simply not enforce the intellectual property over these materials that were being publicized. Of course, the situation now is very different. There's the Viacom case is going to decide whether it was indeed infringing materials or not. And there's also a lot of agreements that YouTube is being pursuing, like with Warner, with copyright holders. But if you think about it, if you look at a peer-to-peer network, it's the same thing. It's a huge social commons space, because even though there are no licenses, if you look to those networks, basically intellectual property is not enforced there. It's not enforceable in many cases there. So basically, the funny thing, and that's part of our research, is that when you look at YouTube or peer-to-peer, you see a lot of innovation. But when you look to these practices in the global peripheries, the majority of people only see piracy. And my point is that there's a lot of innovation coming out of the global peripheries. So basically, the same kind of innovation that we see in peer-to-peer networks, that we see at YouTube, that we see, you know, in any business model that has to do with cultural production that emerged like in the past 7 years, that same innovation is also taking place whenever you have a peripheral group appropriating technology. And my point is that you have to pay attention to that innovation, learn the lessons that it has to teach, and understand how you can disseminate those ideas to improve your idea of business, of competitiveness, etc. So I think that's very important.
So do you see particular policy implications for the, based on the research that you've conducted, mm-hmm. and these trends that you've seen and this phenomenon?
Yeah. Actually, the most important thing that we realized is that these models, they only work because they are innovative. They have the flexibility to innovate. So, for instance, the Tecnobrega model. As I mentioned, they are always creating new sources of revenues. So one of the recent developments was basically to insert a piece of advertisement in the beginning of all the CDs. So you buy the CDs, and then you listen to someone that is sponsoring that particular CD. Also, they started recording their presentations live, and they were going to do, for instance, shout-outs for the audience and say, oh, the people from this and this neighborhood. And then people say, wah. And then when they leave, the CD with their saying, hey, hello, guys, it was just there. So they were buying the CDs because they developed this business model of live recording their presentations and selling them when people were going home. So basically, these are evolutions that are taking place all the time. One research that we did in Argentina recently, actually it finished like a couple of weeks ago, was about this musical scene called Cumbia Villera. And it's fascinating because what we realized is that in Argentina, even the street vendors have become obsolete. All the music is distributed through Bluetooth. So you have this situation in Argentina in which the poorer classes, they don't buy CDs anymore at all. They only get music either through the internet or through Bluetooth by means of cell phone transmissions. And the funny thing is that in Argentina, only rich people are stuck with the CDs. So you have this division in which the rich guys, they are buying CDs, while like the people in the peripheries of Buenos Aires, they have given up of CDs at least for 3 years, and they only use cell phones and the internet to get music. So that's the kind of divide that is going on. And in terms of policy implications, I definitely think that you have to learn about what led these particular communities to innovate the way they did, and what lessons you can extract from this practice. Because what is going on is a huge laboratory of practices, of innovations, of new business models that can actually help crafting not only public policies, but also private practices regarding the music business and any other sort of cultural business.
I mean, it certainly seems that the music business, which has struggled so much in the U.S., for instance, mm-hmm. could stand to learn some of these lessons.
We're at 21 minutes.
Okay, let me ask one last question.
Okay.
So what are you going to work on? What's your next research project?
Right.
What are you
going to work on next? So basically, we completed this first phase of the Open Business Project. And when we finished, we had a dilemma, which was, should we continue like researching other cultural scenes to see what's going on there? And we decided not to do that because we already knew the results. It was going to be the same all over the country. And why keep doing that? Because we already know what is going on. So we decided to take another problem, which is the issue of informality. And we, for the next 2 years, it started like a couple of months ago, are going to work with the issue of informality. Because the problem of these markets, and that's a problem for the entire developing world and more to the developed world as well, is the division between formal and informal economies. And this is something that is serious and have to be taken into account. So what we are doing now is trying to devise ways that we can help these business models to become more formal and to dialogue with formal economy. So it's not a matter, whenever I say this, people say, oh, but why do you want to formalize them? Are you going to kill these business models? And it's not about it. The challenge is precisely, how do you provide incentives for formalization without losing the flexibilities that made these business models to become so successful? So basically, what we are doing right now is trying to help these business models that were developed and are pretty much under pressure from everyone, because if you are informal, you are under pressure from the police, from the city authorities, from people who want to extract bribes from you. So it's a very unstable situation in which you have to deal with all these pressures. So we want to help these business models to become more formalized in order to avoid these pressures and also to have access to formal credit lines, to more institutional support, to dialogue more broadly with the government, and so it goes. So basically, we have taken this mission, which is not easy at all. For the next 2 years, we are going to be working on that. And for the next 2 years, that's for Brazil. We continue to do research about scenes and musical scenes outside Brazil. So now we are working with the Cumbia Villera in Argentina, and we are also working with Colombia, in the Atlantic part of Colombia, Barranquilla, Cartagena and these cities, which have a very interesting sound system culture, and we are trying to understand their business models. And hopefully in the future, the same work that we are doing now for informality in Brazil, we can also do in Argentina and Colombia. But first, we want to try to understand what's going on there so that we can eventually expand the project there too.
I've heard bits of these stories, and I mean, mm-hmm. both when, before